The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. Support comes from the Grove Hotel, Boise State University's School of Public Service, St. Luke's, and Perkins Coie. Forum series sponsors for the City Club are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mind Development. Additional grant funding comes from the Idaho Humanities Council, a state-based partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The premier sponsor for the City Club of Boise is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Annual sponsor for the City Club is St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Catherine Himes.
Our sincere thanks to those of you who support City Club of Boise with membership or a donation during registration. I'm going to introduce the panelists in alphabetical order. Dr. Seth Ashley is Associate Professor of Communication and Media and Arbiter Advisor at Boise State University. Dr. Ashley studies news literacy, media and democracy, media sociology, communication law and policy, media history, political communication, and civic engagement. Dr. Charlie Hunt's research focuses primarily on the U.S. Congress, congressional elections, partisanship, and representation. He is assistant professor at Boise State University in the political science program of the School of Public Service. And our third panelist, Mr. Kirk Siegler, is a national cultural and political correspondent for National Public Radio and is based in Boise, Idaho. His beat explores the intersection and divisions between rural and urban America. Mr. Siegler helped open NPR's first ever bureau in Idaho at the studios of Boise State Public Radio in 2019. Each panelist will give an opening statement up to 5 minutes that addresses this question through their particular lens. For example, national journalism, political science, media literacy. So the first up is Dr. Seth Ashley. Seth, from your perspective, what are key ways in which Election Day 2020 will be a wild ride?
Thanks, Catherine. Great to be here. I would just simply say rampant misinformation and disinformation. That's the place to start. Just expect, you know, I think it's going to be a huge mess throughout the week, probably, and maybe even beyond. So, you know, this I noticed this panel was about, it said something about how not to go crazy yourself. I think it's okay to go a little crazy. I mean, we're living through a fairly crazy and unprecedented time. So I think that's okay to give yourself permission to go a little nuts. You know, how to kind of limit that as much as possible. I think just avoid social media as much as you can. Stick to the sources of reputable original news reporting. So the places not commentary and analysis, but the places that are gonna give it to you as straight as possible. The Associated Press, NPR, New York Times, the places that are gonna give that are not going to, you know, stick to the facts. We never have had a final count on election night. It always takes days to certify. And we can only assume that this one's going to drag on. I think it's scary because there's a lot of indicators of kind of social collapse. It's kind of as bad as it's been in a while. And so I think the kind of existential threat that a lot of people are feeling right now is to an action or at least the support of violence. I'm a little worried about that. And I think that's why we need to be really aware of the potential for misinformation, meaning stuff that's just wrong. And then disinformation, that's the kind of intentionally misleading propaganda and the stuff that just is out there, intentionally put out there to mislead and confuse people. There's gonna be a lot of that. So I would prepare now for that. What can we do about that? I from the context of news and media literacy, this is all about the knowledge and skills that we have and that we need to critically analyze our information environment. So first, let's think of it from an individual level perspective. And that's where our own confirmation biases come into play. You know, we have to be really aware of our own patterns of consumption. Humans just really like to stick to stuff that confirms their prior beliefs. We don't like to hold competing thoughts in our head. We have this simplicity bias, which leads us toward conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking. The third person effect, where we assume that other people are more affected by messages than we are. All these things that we know from psychology, the hostile media effect, where partisans can see the same piece of content as biased against their point of view. So we have to be really wary of how we approach this and the context that we bring as individuals. And then the kind of yang to that yin is the understanding the media system in general. And that's, thinking critically about how these social media giants that are run by a small handful of billionaires, these are not benign information services or public services. These are giant for-profit corporations that are doing everything they can to keep you on the screen and keep you clicking. They're not there mainly to provide a public service. They've done some things recently to help improve the situation a little bit, but I worry that it's too little too late, and it's easy enough to circumvent the protections they've put in place. All of this is happening in the context of the decline of journalism. This has been happening for 15 years or more at least. But it's gotten really bad lately. In some cases, we're just seeing the death of journalism in local communities, which has nationalized our politics and sort of led people to pick sides more firmly than we've seen in a long time. So I think it's important to understand the larger context this is all happening in. We have so many for-profit media operations that are focused more than anything on their bottom line. And so that's a big part of the pattern that we're seeing and has led to the hollowing out of the middle and kind of the increased polarization we're seeing. This is all kind of the logical extension of the neoliberal context we're in when we squeeze, nearly every drop of public service and public goods out of our society. It's kind of no surprise that we end up in a mess like we're in now. So I wish I had a more optimistic message. I think it's okay to be a little nervous about this week, how it's going to go. Let's all just be patient as much as possible. Know that things are going to be wrong. We're going to be people are going to intentionally try to mislead us. So let's just try to be patient and hang in there and know that it's going to take a while to sort this all out.
Thanks, Seth. We heard you talk about it's not just election day, it's election week. And that was a wild ride indeed. Kirk, I'm going to turn to you. From your perspective, what are key ways in which election day 2020 will be a wild ride?
Usually the reporter is the one giving the more gloomy view. So I feel like I'm suddenly an optimist all of a sudden. No, I'm kidding. I would say people have been asking me this question a lot, actually. Colleagues, not all of us are traveling right now. I have been traveling due to the pandemic and other restrictions, and going to communities and visiting people and talking to voters. And other friends have asked me this question too, and family, like, what do you think's, what's going to happen? And my response is sort of a punt in the sense that in the Trump era, if there's one consistent thing that I've noticed, is that it's never what you expect. So we can get into all these scenarios and predict this, and the clickbait news media and social media has to have this prediction, and here's what's going to happen. I'm talking to you from the airport literally right now as I'm on my way to Arizona, which is, just this morning was out with it's Arizona and Pennsylvania. It's going to come down to those two states. Well, honestly, we don't know, like Seth said. So I think, if that's one consistency, we don't know. And I like the advice there to be patient, keep apprised to the news sources you trust, the legacy news sources, that we are in the business for information and informing the public. We are not in the business of misinformation or disinformation or sowing discord. I gather probably speaking to, as I said, I'm at the airport. Sorry if there's planes in the background, but I gather, we may be speaking to a choir in this sense, a very informed audience. But one thing also that I found myself doing this morning, I can't avoid social media for the obvious, because especially in a pandemic, this is where information gets pushed out by various news agencies and the authorities and elections officials. So I have to watch it. But, I've actually gone through my feed this morning and started unfollowing people, even people I know and are friends with who really, I would say, contribute to my doom scrolling. I just don't need that right now. I don't really need to see that. I've had to reach out to a couple of friends via text, like, could you just stop texting me your personal worst case scenario right now, because I don't think it's helping. That's been one of my suggestions for trying to cope with it. I would say one other thing before we move on to the other panelists, back to the point about, what's going to happen. I agree. This is a very volatile and extremely uncertain time in this country, to the likes of which we have probably not faced. However, because of the way the news media has shrunk or consolidated to the coasts, I guess I'm kind of an outlier because I work for a national organization and I'm a national correspondent who's in the heartland, so to speak. But I do think that, and coupled with that and the pandemic, a lot of reporters aren't able to be out really understanding what's going on right now because of the pandemic, because of the lockdowns. We're just not out there talking to as many people as we might normally. We know how the polls, worked in 2016. So there's a fair amount of anxiety looking at the polls again, people trying to make these predictions and not knowing what's going on. But violence is for sure a concern. At the risk of sounding like a hypocrite here, I don't know that there's been enough attention paid in the mainstream news media. There's certainly been a lot of worthy attention on the vigilantes, the armed militia groups that may be trying to intimidate people at the polls or have already been doing that, or concerns about the Proud Boys, headquartered just a couple hundred miles to the west of us here in Boise. Coming out, or groups like that coming out. But I don't know that there's been as much attention on what could happen if Trump wins in the cities in particular, and even cities like Boise. I think you would see huge numbers of people out in the streets. And that's also something to be concerned about. Not people being out in the streets themselves, that's a concern. But I think that major unrest, major civil unrest could follow, frankly, either way this goes. So that's a concern. Or to wrap things up, it's never what you think it's going to be in the Trump era.
I heard doom scrolling. It's never what you think it's going to be, and what's happening in the rest of November. Thanks so much, Kirk, for painting your vision of the wild ride. Let's turn now to our third panelist, Charlie. From your perspective, what are key ways in which Election Day 2020 will be a wild ride?
Thanks, Catherine. I appreciate it. So the way I'm thinking about this question is sort of in terms of what we know right now and what we still don't know, the day before Election Day. So we know what the polls say. They've painted a pretty consistent picture. Honestly, over the past 8 months, they've all shifted very, very little. You mentioned Pennsylvania and Arizona, or Kirk mentioned Pennsylvania and Arizona. Sure, those are the states to watch. We know generally what voters think about Donald Trump and Joe Biden. We know that Joe Biden is a more sort of broadly popular candidate than Hillary Clinton was 4 years ago. We know that, most voters have a fairly negative opinion of Donald Trump, but that enough of them have a favorable opinion that he's still in the game. We know that early voting and mail-in voting turnout has been absolutely astronomical. We don't necessarily know what that means, but we know that that is happening, particularly in places like Texas and Florida. For me, it's the things that we don't know that are going to be sort of taking us for a wild ride. So the things that we don't know that I'll sort of be watching for are, number one, Election Day turnout. Is there enough, we know that early and mail-in votes are, strongly anticipated that they'll be really favoring Vice President Biden. Will there be enough Election Day turnout for Donald Trump to, have him be able to take control in some of these states? The second thing we don't know is exactly how long it will take certain states to count absentee ballots and mail-in ballots, as well as some of these early voting numbers. As Seth alluded to, this is election week, right? Or weeks, maybe not election day. We do know the relative order of when some of these states should be coming in. We know, for example, that a lot of the, early, we'll know what's going on in the Sun Belt states generally, probably sooner than we'll know what's going on in those Rust Belt or Upper Midwest states. But there are still a number of X factors there, in part because, you know, ballot counting is very bifurcated and trifurcated. It's you know, elections are administered at the state and county levels generally, and this is not something that's done at the federal level. And with that in mind, it's, you know, the obvious other factor here, what we don't know is exactly how the Trump campaign, how Republicans, and how the courts will respond if we don't know the results on election night. We know what Donald Trump has said over the past few days and weeks, which is that, oh, if we don't know by election night, it's not legitimate. And this goes to some of the concerns that Seth was talking about, which, you know, that's all obviously false. We, in fact, have rarely in recent years really known the winner on election night. And when we do feel like we know the winner, those are based on, you know, result projections from the news media and not based on sort of certified actual election results, which the states usually have a number of weeks to actually complete. So we don't know exactly how they'll respond. You know, if it's a decisive Biden, if it looks like it's going to be a decisive Biden victory, are the Republicans really going to put up a huge fight? Or are they just going to kind of grumble about it and recede quietly into the night? That's a big X factor here, because I think a lot of the you know, the unrest that Kirk talked about and a lot of the disinformation that Seth talked about depends in large part on signals from the president and from the campaigns generally. And so how much his heart is really in this sort of disinformation campaign once the results start coming in is something we still don't know, and is something I'll be watching for on this kind of wild ride. So it's really in these areas of what we don't know where I think a lot of this, the sort of shenanigans and disinformation and misinformation can sneak in. So I totally agree with Seth and Kirk that's really where we need to start. I mean, for me, I'll be doing a lot of the same things Kirk said, maybe unfollowing some folks that need some unfollowing. And maybe we'll try to stick a little more on the analysis side rather than the punditry side, with apologies to, you know, David Gergen and the like. So that's what I'll be looking for.
Charlie, thank you for talking to us about the difference with what we know, what we don't know, and how that plays into the wild ride. I would like to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Seth Ashley, Charles Hunt, and Kirk Siegler. We're now going to turn to questions from our audience. So we touched on this in the opening. This has to do with misinformation. Many Americans are concerned about spreading misinformation. What are nonpartisan sources of information? How can people determine whether the information is trustworthy, accurate, and so forth? And really, how do you distinguish misinformation from disinformation? So a lot in that question, it's really open for anyone who's ready to tackle that topic. Seth?
I'll jump in and say, I think, you know, seeking out non-commercial sources is a good place to start. Non-commercial, nonprofit sources, they sort of have less to gain from, you know, trying to be speedy and giving you a great hot take. I think they're the ones that are more likely to be cautious and careful. So I would stress that. I hate telling people what sources of information to consume, but like Kirk said, you know, the legacy sources, we know those sources with basically the resources and the newsrooms to hire the people that can sort through all of this stuff and make sense of it and help explain it to us. I mean, that's where you're going to get the best information. And the difference between mis and disinformation, how to tell the difference. I mean, disinformation is the stuff that goes out of its way to mislead or deceive you. Misinformation is just getting it wrong. And so, which happens from time to time on the internet. So, you know, I think it's important to know the difference, but just know that there's going to be a lot of that swarming around out there, and to just be prepared for that. Just expect it.
I would say, you know, this is a real problem. From someone at the highest levels of government has spent most of his term, the administration for that matter, and some Republicans trying to discredit the news media. Now, what is the news media? The news media is a huge range of of outlets, as Seth said, some for profit, some profiting off Discord, cable news, there's legacy news media, there's reporters like me who like to think anyway that our job is to go out and, you know, of course we have biases. Nobody does not have a bias, but it's my job as a reporter to roam around the Western US, talk to people, hear them out, put their stories out on the air and their arguments out on the air to lay that out for the news consumer to make their own informed decision. That's how things have always worked. Now they've been kind of flipped up onside their head. And I would tell you that as a there's a whole chunk of the public right now who is looking at a totally different news feed than the other, than another side of the public, to wit, I was in Arizona a couple of weeks ago, and we've got a very, very electorate on edge. And I was out in front of a polling station in a more rural Arizona county. And because I was the news media, I was immediately shouted at. And I don't get this that often, to be honest. You know, a socialist, I'm controlled by the lobbyists and the overlords, which I think is probably a factor of people looking at a totally different, almost like alternate universe newsfeed. And then they said, well, it's nothing personal. It's like, well, feels pretty personal. But, you know, and these are just minor stories of what's happening right now. Other reporters will tell you something far different. I just was taken a little bit aback because that is not the norm of people that I tend to encounter on my regular job in communities. They're, you know, they may have met I may be the first reporter they've actually met. But it seems as though that the electorate is very on edge. And because of the disinformation, convinced already everything's a foregone conclusion. So that may, as the other panelists have said, be problematic if in fact on election night or the days after, if it hasn't been decided or we're in a close race, there may be one chunk of, or a chunk of the electorate who just doesn't believe the results. So I guess I'll stop there because I think we'll get down the very hole that I was warning about, predicting too much because we just don't know at this point. But that's kind of my view from the ground as being out in communities right now and visiting polling stations and talking to voters.
Thanks, Kirk. Charlie, looks like you're ready.
Yeah. I'll just say one quick thing. I'll leave the media talk to the media experts. I'll stick to politics. But you know, one thing I've been thinking about a lot over the past few months, you know, as we've you know, all been going through this COVID situation together. You know, we've been talking about mail-in ballots for months now. And, you know, what I had been looking for and that generally I've been sort of happy with what I've seen is that the news outlets, the sort of the legacy news outlets have, I think, done a pretty good job setting expectations for election night, talking about how we can expect because of this, you know, flux of mail-in ballots that we're going to be in for a long night or a long week. And so at this point, my only question going into tomorrow night is goes to sort of what Kirk was just talking about, you know, how polarized and bifurcated is our news media environment? Is it so bifurcated that this sort of alternate universe, this sort of, you know, maybe very far right kind of Fox News sort of universe, will that translate into serious unrest or serious bifurcation in terms of how voters are interpreting the fact that we may not know on election night. So how those media dynamics play in is something I'm really interested in going into tomorrow.
Thanks, Charlie. You mentioned election night. That's exactly where this question is going. You know, today is the day before the election. Tomorrow's election day. As returns start coming in, where will you be looking when you're really interested in what's certain? Are there states that you're going to follow more than others? Are there statistics or reports? Where can people go to find these bits of information, particularly on election night this year? Kirk.
I can start. Yeah. at the risk of sounding self-serving, I did just disclose I'm on my way to Phoenix, but I do think Arizona will be an interesting place to watch. Arizona has not voted for a Democrat since 1992. And in fact, I think that was the only time in modern history in the presidential election. The turnout, we're talking about high turnout. And of course, we don't know at this point. I mean, there's high turnout, already high early voting turnout in much of Idaho. That would be a good indicator that we don't know. I can't see a huge swing in the electorate in a state like Idaho voting for Biden. So we don't know who the early turnout is. I would qualify that. You know, traditionally, if anything was in normal times, we'd be talking about, well, high early turnout tends to benefit Democrats. But what I'm watching really closely is Maricopa County. That's sort of the rock bed, traditional Republican stronghold. Barry Goldwater, not unlike Orange County, California, in some respects. Maricopa County, home to the famous anti-immigration sheriff, Joe Arpaio, has Maricopa County, kind of like Orange County, has gotten a little bit more diverse. Latinos have come of voting age, and two-thirds, depending on which survey you look at, two-thirds of Latinos tend to vote Democrat. There's been a lot of people moving into Maricopa County from California, from other states, a lot of younger people. Changing demographics there in 2016, this is a story that didn't get a lot of attention because of the obvious of what happened on 2016, but large turnout in particular in Latino communities was credited for ousting Sheriff Joe Arpaio. There was a nugget out of the Maricopa Elections Office just last night, I believe, that showed that the turnout there has already surpassed overall turnout in 2016. So conventional wisdom is and has been, if you take Maricopa County, or you have to win Maricopa County to win Arizona. I think this is why the pundits are putting and have been putting, along with the polls, Biden with a slight edge there. I'll believe it when I see it, if Biden actually wins Arizona. But Arizona, I think, will be one to watch, and turnout there is certainly key. And what's been interesting that we've been reporting on at NPR and recently, Trump has actually skipped Phoenix, has mostly skipped for his rallies in more rural areas, the pundits anyway are trying to parse what that could mean. But there is some thinking that if you get a huge turnout in rural Arizona, you could maybe lose Phoenix and Maricopa County and still take the state. Who knows what's going to happen with the turnout where it is, but we do know there's a pretty sharp urban-rural divide in the country. And I think in these battleground states like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, where Trump is trying to go after the rural vote, I'd be watching that really closely. On the other hand, and I'll wrap up here in a second, I would say that healthcare is a big issue in rural areas, and we can't treat the rural vote as one monolithic thing either. So it could be seen as a bit of a gamble on Trump's part as well. So these are all things I'll be watching very closely, the rural vote and particular Arizona.
Kirk, just a quick follow-up. Are there any particular statistics, sources of information you'll be using tomorrow night as the results come in? Any places we should really send our listeners, our viewers today?
Well, I'm going to sound self-serving, but at NPR.org. We're also leaning very heavily on the Associated Press as usual. I think the AP is a stalwart for election night. I would highly recommend watching the AP and New York Times is often in front of the AP with county level data coming in. So I'd be watching both of those very closely. And when you look at the states, sometimes some of the websites can drill down into which counties have not come in yet. So that's an important thing to look at. I'm thinking of Nextdoor in Montana in 2018, where Senator John Tester looked like he was about to be unseated. And everybody went to bed that night thinking he might have been ousted. But one key thing was that Missoula County and Gallatin County, the two kind of Democratic strongholds there, hadn't reported yet or had had very little reporting yet. And that, when those votes started coming in, it tipped the balance back in favor of testers. So just because one state looks like it's going one way, I think all the listeners and audience know to there's more to the story.
Thanks so much. Charlie, Seth, anything to add to this question? Charlie.
Yeah, sure. So I agree with everything Kirk just said. You know, where I'll be looking, you know, Kirk mentioned the importance of county level results, and I think that's absolutely right. If you're looking for you know, indications of how certain states might go, especially as some of these results will be slower to trickle in. I think looking at counties are key, you know, particularly counties, you know, where I'll be looking are counties that, you know, had voted for President Obama in 2008 and 2012, and then switched over to Trump in 2016. These are areas where Biden, you know, back at least some of that support. And then a lot of these suburban counties, you know, these are ones that have been really traditionally Republican, but that in 2018 underwent a really, really enormous kind of seismic blue wave, shifting back towards Democrats for House and Senate and gubernatorial races. And it seems like this sort of suburban blue wave is showing no signs of stopping. And so those, the extent to which Biden can continue to make huge gains in those counties, you know, places like Collin County, Texas, will be interesting to see if he can build up enough of a wall there such that whatever new gains the president will make in rural areas, and you know, there are going to be new Trump voters this year, that, you know, there was and is room for him to grow, but all indications seem to say that Biden is you know, riding this blue wave in suburban counties. And then I'll also be looking at counties that are sort of bellwether counties, ones that are reasonable demographic and political approximations of the state as a whole. And if those come in a little earlier, those can be, you know, good early information to have. And as far as who I trust on things like this, of course, NPR and AP as well. I totally agree with Kirk. And for sort of fine-grained data and analysis on this county-level data, Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report, I think, does some really rigorous data work in this area, as well as Nate Cohn of the New York Times. They both have really granular, more granular than I could ever hope to have, knowledge of some of these individual counties and their political cultures. And, you know, those are two people I will be following tomorrow night, who I generally trust to sort of give me the cold hard facts about, you know, what small slivers of results can potentially, but not definitely, tell us about the larger results in some of these states.
Thanks, Charlie. Anything to add, Seth?
I would just again stress that election night is largely an invention of the news media itself. And the whole idea of, you know, sitting and watching returns, it's fun. It's like, you know, sports for political junkies, but just expect that, you know, we're not going to know, especially this year. And I think, you know, it's important to remember that I think we can't talk about this without mentioning the Electoral College and what a weird, totally bizarre operation it is. You know, it's several weeks. Of course, when you vote for a president, you don't vote for the, you're not voting for the candidate, you're voting for his or her electors. And so, you know, then it's the deadline is, I don't know, it's weeks from now, maybe even December, when the electors actually get together and, you know, then decide to go cast the votes on behalf of the candidates. So, I mean, it's a completely bizarre process. And that's why I think we just need to get away from this notion of knowing anything definitive tomorrow night. So not to discount the political analysis that will give us some indicators, some possible early indicators. But I would just stress to everyone to just be patient.
Thanks, Seth. Great foreshadow of the next question. This question has to do with hard dates for specifics, like the Electoral College date, when returns need to be finalized. And connected with this, a question about, will tomorrow night, instead of seeing percentage precincts reporting, will it divide that into absentee, mail-in ballots, in-person ballots? What will it really look like tomorrow night, and what are those hard dates?
Oh, well, I was only going to say I wish we had a county clerk on to give us the official dates, but a lot of times we don't know all the post-game for weeks more when they break it down, just because many different states have different rules about when absentee ballots can begin being counted. Some ballots have already been counted in other states. So to Seth's point, I think I would say that it's important to keep in mind that we may not know a lot of things come tomorrow night.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, as far as I can speak to the sort of when, you know, as I mentioned earlier, each state has its different system for how to tabulate votes, and the counties all have different systems, right? As far as when, you know, as Seth said, we never know officially who won on election night, even if we have projections, right? The states certify their results on different dates. You know, most take at least a week and some take several weeks. I mean, there are a number of states that, you know, Texas doesn't need to certify its final results until December 3rd. You know, that in theory, and hopefully in practice, should give it a great deal of leeway. And part of the reason we have that leeway is because you want to make sure it's done right. You want to make sure that you're counting votes carefully and correctly, and you're getting them all in accordance with however each state does its particular laws. And Seth is right. The Electoral College didn't meet until well into December. So it's, you know, it's, we don't have to be pressed for time here. All the time that's going on is sort of political maneuvering. And I think that speaks to sort of Seth's earlier point that this, you know, election night, while it is interesting for political junkies like me, it is sort of an illusion, right? It's, you know, these certification dates are the state laws that states set long in advance of this election, in most cases, even well before COVID hit. And those are the dates that should really matter.
And don't get me wrong, I'm going to be tuned in tomorrow night too. I'm going to be on social media, and I'm going to be doing all the terrible things that I just told you not to do. So do as I say, not as I do. But here, I just wanted to read the actual language from the Constitution. It's the Monday after the second Wednesday in December of presidential election years. That's when the electors actually vote in their state. So that's December 14th. And then January 6th is a joint session of Congress to count the electoral votes and declare the election results. So again, we've got plenty of time. That's kind of the point. We basically know that Trump is going to declare victory tomorrow night, no matter what. So we know that we should ignore that and let it play out, because most likely we're not gonna have anything close enough to results for anyone to declare victory tomorrow night, or even probably Wednesday or Thursday.
I would add also really quickly, one thing we haven't talked about, and maybe we'll get to it, is election security itself. You know, that's a big concern right now. We haven't heard a lot about, you know, voting machines and protections. I know that county officials are doing everything they normally do, and most, for that matter, are saying and reassuring the public about their processes. If there's anything really good that's come about from all this instability, I guess you could call it, is that it's been an opportunity, I think, for some county clerks and elections officials to really be out there educating the public about and about what half signatures are, what the, all of the measures that are in place to protect and shield against fraud, which we know is there are very few instances of that. So I think if there's been one silver lining, it's that most people probably now provisional ballots are a household term. So we're learning more about the process. Although that said, it can be very confusing, especially when you consider 50 states and 50 different jurisdictions and jurisdictions within those states. Yeah.
If I could add to that, I would just point also to the real concerns for tomorrow: voter intimidation, voter suppression, and then ultimately political influence and interference with the vote counting process. I mean, those are, I think, the things that we need to be watching out for starting tomorrow. You know, we know that there are likely to be, you know, armed poll watchers. That's scary for a lot of people. That could even turn people away. We've you know, made it very hard to vote in lots of places in this country. We've seen the 10-hour lines for early voting in some places. We'll see more of that tomorrow. We made it very hard to vote, which I think amounts to voter suppression. And then I think, you know, I'm thinking of a lot of people have said we could very well have another 2000 where we like a Bush v. Gore situation, where it comes down to, you know, political players influencing how these recounts, or how even the initial counting, what counts, what's legitimate, all of that. That's going to be messy. So those are the things that I think, you know, I'm going to be watching for more than just, you know, who's ahead at any given moment.
Charlie, anything to add here in terms of election day security, interference?
You know, I think Seth and Kirk said it all. One thing I'll add on based on what Kirk said is, you know, a good account you can follow on Twitter, if you are so inclined to be on Twitter, is the Ada County Elections Office. They show a lot of really awesome video that, you know, shows people working on the ballots, getting them counted, the sorting machines and things like that. That kind of transparency, I have to believe, helps a little bit, at least with, you know, allaying voters' fears that there are nefarious things going on. I mean, you know, we talked a lot in 2016, of course, and then in the years after about, you know, foreign interference in our elections. And it looks more like this time, not to say that isn't happening, but it looks more like this time that, you know, the call is coming from inside the House, and that it's mostly sort of based on our own fears and our own disinformation that's happening. And so, and that in a lot of ways worries me a lot more than foreign interference, but yeah, I'll be watching that as well.
Let's shift a little bit. Let's turn to other races. So these are sometimes called down ballot. So which state races should we be interested in that might have bigger implications nationally?
So, you know, as we may know, the Senate is looking like it's pretty well up for grabs at this point. Since he's headed there, I'll let Kirk talk about Arizona, where there's, you know, been what has appeared to be a seat that Democrats are pretty well positioned to pick up in the Senate, Martha McSally's seat. But of course, we don't know. We'll see. But there are, you know, a couple of different tiers of Senate races. You have this group of five or six states, you know, Alaska, Kansas, and Montana, and South Carolina, and Texas, states that were not even close to being on the table in sort of analysts' initial predictions of sort of which Senate seats would be impactful. They're states that Democrats, you know, based on the demographics, don't really have any business being competitive in, but they are. That doesn't mean any of them will win, but it has forced Republicans to play defense in those areas. But in the end, it's you know, control of the Senate is gonna come down probably to Arizona, Colorado, Maine, and North Carolina, as well potentially as Iowa and these two Georgia seats that are up. Speaking of, you know, not knowing things on election day, both of these Georgia Senate seats could be subject to a runoff if nobody gets above 50%. And those would take place, I think, in December, January. So it's also possible that even if we have all the votes counted, we may not know about something like control of the Senate, much less who won the presidency. So that's another thing voters should be prepared to know about as far as Georgia is concerned, based on the rules they have in play. And then I'll just say, you know, as far as the House is concerned, I don't know that at the end of 2018, this sort of historic blue wave in the House, that anybody would have predicted that sort of the average prediction here would be that Democrats would actually pick up a few additional seats. It's pretty remarkable considering the vast amount of territory that they're sort of protecting, that they won in 2018. A lot of these sort of frontline districts that Donald Trump won in 2016, but that Democrats won back in the House in 2018. And so it's looking quite unlikely that Republicans will take back the House. And then as far as the Senate, you know, who knows?
I'll answer this really quick, because I have to go to Arizona. Charlie's point, Martha McSally, Mark Kelly, the race in Arizona. again, depending on how closely you look at the polls, Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabby Giffords, of course, and the astronaut. I'm watching that race. I'm watching the Montana race very closely and the Colorado race very closely between former Denver and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper and Cory Gardner, in part because of public lands, which are a big interest in here in the West, but also my beat, of course, and where these three senators were going to fall and potentially would fall on a nomination of the extremely controversial Bureau of Land Management acting director or temporary director, depending on what day it is, I guess, William Perry Penley. These three senators were very vulnerable and are very vulnerable in their races, and they would have faced a very tough and potentially tricky vote when it came to a potential confirmation of him. Now, I think if Trump were to win, or if he wins on Tuesday or thereafter, there's going to be quite a mandate he would get when it comes to public lands. So I'll be watching who wins these races in particular. They're both, you know, it's often said that, you know, everybody in the West here has to out public land each other. It's a very bipartisan issue. But that issue about the Bureau of Land Management leader and how some of these senators didn't speak out against him, I think is how you would say that. That, of course, William Perry Penley, who in the past had called for the sale or transfer of federal public lands to states or private interests. This thorny issue of public lands and who's leading these federal lands agencies, the senators have a lot to say on that. I mean, we get back to a scenario where we're not having just acting agency directors, and these actually come before Senate for a confirmation process. So I'll be watching those three states particularly closely.
Thanks, Kirk, and best wishes for safe travels to Arizona. Thanks for being
Thank you very much.
Seth, thoughts on this question?
I'll just leave it to the political experts.
Well, let's move into another topic here. This is, how are you personally going to navigate information on election day? Where are you going to look? How are you going to take yourself off of the wild ride, the title of this City Club? And how do you check yourself and your preferred sources for biases? Before Kirk left, he talked about how he was really reducing the amount of time he's spending on social media, actually removing, you know, some of the people he's following and so forth. But for the two of you, what are you going to be doing today, tomorrow? And if we're looking at November, December, maybe all the way up until the beginning of January, what are you going to do personally to stay away from this wild ride? And while you're thinking, before you answer, I'm going to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Seth Ashley, Charles Hunt, and Kirk Siegler.
Well, as far as what I'll be doing whatever Seth tells me is the healthiest thing to do as far as media consumption, or at least I'll be saying that's what I'll try to do. There's, you know, as Seth alluded to earlier, there will probably be a gap between what I say I should do and what I actually do. You know, I'm going to try and, you know, roller coasters can be fun, but they end up at the same place that they started. So, you know, it can, you know, what I'll be trying to do is not put too much investment into each tiny new little nugget of information or data I get and try and fit it into a broader picture of what's going on. You know, In some ways, you know, because of my job, I have to, I teach my students about this stuff and I want to be able to talk to them about it. And I want to be able to, you know, tell them with some semblance of credibility, what kinds of things they should or shouldn't be looking at, or, you know, what kinds of interpretations may be a little faulty. And so in some ways I have to follow this stuff really closely. I will try and keep the Twitter to a minimum. That's sort of where I get into trouble. As far as following down sort of, you know, data rabbit holes, but for the average American, most of us really don't require that level of detail. And it sort of becomes, you know, as Seth alluded to before, more of a sport or a hobby. There's been some research recently, some really good research by Eitan Hirsch about political hobbyism, basically engaging in politics as, you know, as you might in like a volleyball game, or, you know, reading a particular kind of book, or engaging in some hobby rather than engaging in it as this sort of broader civic duty, and ascribing more meaning and seriousness to it. I think presidential elections are kind of the Super Bowl for political hobbyists, and I don't mean that as a good thing. So, you know, I know that I'm going to fail at some points tomorrow night. I think we all are in my attempts, but just to try and check that at the door as much as possible, or at least be mindful of when that's happening, when I'm just sort of, you know, losing that broader perspective.
I would approach it in terms of it just being like historically and socially fascinating. I mean, I think like Charlie said, I also want to be able to talk about this with my students. But as I tell my students, I mean, the main reason we're interested in politics is, you know, not because of who wins and loses, but because of what kind of society we want. And so, you know, I try to approach it in terms of, you know, this is just, you know, especially for the nation's oldest democracy, the world's oldest democracy, continuously, you know, what do we want for ourselves? And so I think, you know, I kind of have to step back and see the big picture and the kind of long historical arc. Yes, this is a hugely intense and historical moment, but it's also a snapshot in time. And I think if we can kind of see it in that larger picture and enjoy the journey just as much a little bit, you know, and hopefully no one gets hurt along the way. I guess that's what I would say.
Thanks, Charlie and Seth. What are topics really important to Election Day 2020 and how we navigate this wild ride that we have not covered yet in the City Club? Shifting into sort of your closing thoughts on this conversation.
You know, one thing I'm thinking about is the issues that are and aren't important to voters, you know, what our voters are basing their decisions on tomorrow. And I say tomorrow, but most of the people who are going to vote have already voted. You know, it's, you know, we're on Zoom right now. The coronavirus is, you know, really peaking in an unsettling way for the third time here. And I think sort of pursuant to what I was talking about before, a lot of people are sort of focusing on the election. You know, it's good that we're focusing on it, but it's also just because we're desperate for something else to focus on. We're all exhausted. We're all tired. We want this to be over. And, you know, at least as far as voters are concerned, this along with the economy, which, and of course they're tightly intertwined issues, are incredibly important to them. A lot of voters are basing their vote on, you know, who they think will do a better job responding to this pandemic. And it's easy to sort of, again, lose sight of this broader perspective about, you know, the number of people who are being hospitalized or losing their lives each day. And especially in a lot of these states that are going to decide this election. And so I think you can trust that that's going to be on voters' minds, and we hope also will be on our elected leaders' minds, regardless of who wins in the coming weeks. So that's just sort of something that, as if you need a reminding that coronavirus was out there, it's just something that's kind of in all of the back of our minds and is tough to set aside even for just the night, because it's all sort of intertwined here.
Thanks, Charlie. Seth, some closing thoughts. Which topics haven't we covered, and what words of advice do you have for our participants today in terms of navigating this wild ride?
Yeah, it feels pretty comprehensive. I just think this is such a great entry point for people into news and media literacy. I mean, I think this is just a really great moment to practice all that we preach in terms of becoming better consumers of information. I mean, you know, my students sometimes ask, why does it have to be so hard? You know, it's almost as if it is like this by design. Well, in some ways it is. Since the advent of commercial broadcasting 100 years ago, this is just kind of the path that we've been on. So, you know, so I think we have to adapt to that information environment that we're in, and take responsibility for our own participation in it, both our consumption and our own production, because we are constantly sharing information ourselves, both online and with others offline. So I think, you know, we can all practice news and media literacy for this election and also going forward. It's a kind of a bummer that this is the reason we get to talk more about this stuff, but it's good that we're talking about it. I'm curious, what about you, Catherine? You bring your own expertise to this. Do you have any other thoughts that we missed?
You know, I was just thinking during the conversation about security that there have been quite a number of panels lately here in Boise and elsewhere about security. And one of the big takeaways for me has been the importance of paper as a backup system. That, you know, all of a sudden, you know, there was this big shift to electronic and that we have the electronic voter registry and so forth. But now it's like, well, that paper, that's so important and we can't lose the paper. So I just think about that. And I think about, you know, the challenges in paper storage and so forth. But that just struck me during that conversation, security. And I know that Ada County does a great job. We had a panel and a former elections official spoke about really how we're on the cutting edge here. And that was really heartening to hear. And Seth, I was going to ask you, you know, media literacy, that's a whole field of study. And not everyone knows about that particular field of study within communication. So thanks for sharing those points. For our viewers today and our radio listeners in the future, Kirk Siegler had to fly to Arizona to cover that election. So he's not with us to give a closing perspective. But I do want to remind the audience that the City Club of Boise YouTube channel has a recording of today's virtual conversations. And I also want to thank our panelists, Dr. Seth Ashley, Dr. Charles Hunt, and Mr. Kirk Siegler for participating in today's discussion. Thank you so much. Go vote.
This broadcast of the City Club of Boise was made possible with help from the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, 670 KBOI, and Boise State Public Radio. The premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. The annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. The City Club is a nonpartisan forum with the motto, "Things happen when people start talking." The next City Club of Boise virtual forum is on November 5th. We'll hear from three experts on how the retirement landscape is changing, what states are doing to help, and how efforts brewing in Idaho could boost small businesses across the state. You can register for that forum, again taking place on the 5th of November at cityclubofboise.org. Register for this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of coming events at cityclubofboise.org. or by calling 208-364-4614. Connect on social media by searching for City Club of Boise.